My next guest has an iconic name in Oregon, with degrees from Stanford, Chicago, and Oregon in American history, ethics, and law. John Frohnmayer's views on freedom of speech and public funding of the arts became well known during the first Bush administration, when he was chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. That national debate over obscenity, censorship, and freedom of speech is recounted in his book, Leaving Town Alive, Confessions of an Arts Warrior. John Frohnmayer lives in Southern Oregon and has written many other books, including a trilogy of adventure novels. His latest is titled Lyrics for Laura, Book 3 in the Laura Cole Adventure Series. John joins me in the studio to discuss his novels, the arts, his career, the law, the media, and his views on the current state of our society today. Welcome to the exchange, John.
That's a big order, Mike. Nice to be here. Thanks.
I told you, we don't have enough time.
Yeah.
So we got a lot to cover, but let's start at the beginning. Tell me about your background and how you chose the arts over medical school, the military, the legal profession, even professional singing career.
Well, I grew up in Medford, Oregon. My father, Otto, was a lawyer here. My mother, Maribel, was a musician and a great promoter of the arts. And my family is sort of split between lawyers and musicians. Two of my siblings, my older sister and my now deceased younger brother, Phil, have been professional singers all of their careers. And my brother Dave, who is also unfortunately deceased, and I are lawyers. So we kind of split it down the middle in terms of the siblings going the directions of my mother and my father. I became a lawyer. I thought about a singing career, and I decided I could make a living as a lawyer. I wasn't sure about whether I could make a living as a singer, but I could still sing as a lawyer, and I did. I sang professionally or semi-professionally for all of my life. I have a pretty good case of laryngitis right now. I'm not going to sing for you, or at least not very much. I found that the arts were compelling, that they really were, particularly music, the guiding force of my life. And that has been true to this day.
You call yourself an arts warrior. Why?
Well, during the time that I was at the National Endowment for the arts got more publicity, more letters to Congress than the savings and loan crisis. And just to kind of put that in monetary terms, the savings and loan crisis cost everybody in the United States about $3,000. Everything that the National Endowment for the Arts did cost every taxpayer 68 cents. So you can see that the arts punch above their weight in terms of importance in our society.
So you got a degree at the University of Chicago in ethics?
Yes, I did.
Christian ethics?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I had a Rockefeller grant when I graduated from Stanford, and that was a wonderful program at that time funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, where you could give a look at parish ministry if you had a legitimate interest in it. And I did at that time. I decided I didn't have the faith to be the leader of a flock, but I went to the University of Chicago because they had a program that I thought might kind of bridge the gap between industrial things, you know, things in the business world and ministry. And by the time I got there, it was already clear that that wasn't going to work. And so I just topped it out with a master's in ethics. And of course, during that time, it was the Vietnam War. I knew I was going to get pulled in, and in fact, I did. I spent 3 years in the Navy during Vietnam.
Oh, okay. I was in the Navy too, so.
Yeah? What were you on?
Well, I was on a guided missile cruiser, and I was on an amphib.
Yeah, I was
amphibious assault ship.
I was on Oklahoma City, which is also a guided missile cruiser.
Okay.
Yeah.
Quick question. What is ethics?
Ah, you know, it's interesting because that's exactly the question that the executive officer asked me when I reported aboard my ship. He said, "What'd you take in college?" And I said, "I just finished a master's degree in ethics." And he said, "What's ethics?" And then he put me in engineering, presumably because it started with an E. Ethics is, in I guess the most simplistic sense, how we should act. Law is how you have to act. Ethics is how we should act.
How we should act. Okay, we'll get back to that.
I guess, I may have trouble defending that definition. I just kind of pulled it out of my ear here, but
no, I like your definition. We're going to get back to that. My guest is John Frohnmayer, former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's also the author of many books, including a trilogy of adventure novels, the latest of which is titled Lyrics for Lara. John, we're going to get to your thrilling adventure book after the break. But for now, I don't know if you had a chance to watch the Super Bowl this past weekend.
I watched the second half.
Okay.
Which was, unfortunately, not the good half.
But most importantly, the halftime show with Kendrick Lamar, he made quite a statement using the power of artistic expression on the biggest stage in America. Did you get a chance to see it or hear about it?
I did not see it. I have heard about it. I am astonished that what I have heard about it was that he spent most of the time dissing another rapper. Mm. And I can't imagine that that was what he was asked to do.
It's interesting because I've heard a lot of interpretations of what we saw. And there's a huge discussion around the nation right now because of this art that was on display. Mm. And the interpretation of what was happening and what was unfolding before our eyes is so disparate that it reminds me of when we walk into a art museum and you have a group of people looking at the exact same piece of art, and there are all kinds of wild different interpretations.
Well, while I did not see it, and while it's always a fool's errand to comment on something that you didn't see, it sounds as if that his art did exactly what art is supposed to do, and that is to make us think and to engage us in the conversation of a democracy or of a democratic society. Art should provoke us. Art should make us think. Art should not just relate to beauty and so forth, but to the entire experience of being a human, and not all of it is beautiful.
So that intersection between art and ethics is a place where you've lived, or at least you were in leadership at the National Endowment for the Arts, mm-hmm. during a time when the nation was really struggling with that.
Yes. And the nation is struggling as we speak on a much larger and far more dangerous scale about the nature of democracy, whether it's for the people or whether it's for the very rich. We have some really difficult questions to answer.
Well, speaking of that, the Trump administration accelerated its war on DEI on day one, and the National Endowment for the Arts is in the crosshairs of the target scope. In a press release just last week, the National Endowment for the Arts announced that it had altered its 2026 grant guidelines to prioritize projects that honor the upcoming 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. At the same time, it's eliminating the Challenge America grant, which awards projects to, quote, extend the reach of the arts to underserved groups and communities. That's gone. The focus is on the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. What do you think is the future of the NEA under this administration?
I think it's bleak, frankly. I think this administration is trying to bully its way into a total power control kind of thing out of the executive. I think that in any kind of book that you read about autocracies and the coming of totalitarian governments, the worst thing you can do is to give up early. And it sounds as if the National Endowment for the Arts is trying to make itself acceptable to the president and his flock of people, and I think that's a big mistake. I think it ought to say, here we are, here's what we do, here's what we believe in. If you want to try to axe us, have at it. but you're going to need the help of Congress, at least if you want to follow the law. And of course, that then brings us to another junction of whether this administration is prepared to follow the law if the law shows up. And we'll see about that.
Well, speaking of Congress, in 2016, Congress created the Semi-Quincentennial Commission. Semi-Quincentennial Commission, that's easy for you to say, to oversee the planning, organizing, and execution of the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Why did this responsibility not come under the jurisdiction of the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities?
I can't even speak to that, but I would. I mean, I'm sorry to kind of duck the question, Mike, but it does remind me of the Christopher Columbus quincentennial, or whatever it was, which was during the time that I was at the Arts Endowment, and I, by virtue of that position, was on the committee, and then it sort of occurred to, I don't know whoever, the powers that be, that Columbus wasn't all that popular in terms of Native Americans and the sort of. So what the commission did was to give us all a clock and disband. And it seemed to me that that was maybe the best use of a federal commission that there had ever been.
So tell me, what's the difference between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities?
Well, they are separate but equal in not necessarily in funding. But when the Great Society was proposed under Lyndon Johnson, that was in 1965, the thought was that the arts are so powerful that they will suck up all of the money, and the humanities, which is basically literature, poetry, that, you know, the life of the mind as it's expressed in writing, won't get anything. And so we need two separate endowments so that the college professors can ask for grants and so forth. It played out where both the humanities and the arts overlap a lot in what they fund. But I think it's nice to have two different shots at it, and they seem to function well together.
And so now we have a third organization that is working on the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Yeah. What do you think about this idea of having this new organization that is, I guess, in some ways competing ideologically? Mm-hmm. In other words, Congress creates this new organization that is specifically focused on celebrating and highlighting the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which I don't have to tell you, that has its own problem with a multicultural, multiracial society. Yeah. Meanwhile, it's cutting funding that's going to art education and exposure to the arts at the NEA and the National Endowment for the Humanities. That seems to be playing out with virtually no one saying anything about it.
Well, it's hard to know what to say about Congress right now, because Congress has sort of disappeared. The Republicans in Congress have shown no spine whatsoever. And in terms of challenging the things that Trump is doing, which are essentially, under the Constitution, the purview of Congress. Certainly spending is that. And there is no legal argument about that. That is absolutely true. So I guess the question is complex, and let me just take a couple of bites at it. One is, I think that the more we can talk about the Declaration of Independence, the better off we are, because it is essentially an ethical document. The Constitution is our legal document. It's the supreme law of the land.
I want you to hold that thought.
Okay.
I hear the music. And what you just said is supremely interesting. We need to take a short break. Before the break, you were telling me about the difference between an ethical document and a legal document.
Yes, and the Declaration of Independence really is the nation's ethical document, although it's ethically flawed, and ethics often are flawed because they're the work of human beings, and we are flawed creatures. But basically what the Declaration of Independence tells us is that all men are created equal, and then they're endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's what we as citizens are entitled to in our democracy. And the Constitution is there to make it happen. And we are at a crossroads as we speak, because many commentators are talking about a coup that is going on now with the Trump administration, where the powers of Congress have been usurped by the executive, and the executive is taking control of things like spending, which are clearly legal rights of the Congress as opposed to the executive to impose upon us as citizens. But the other thing that the Declaration of Independence says as an ethical document is that when the government does not provide those things, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it is the right, it is the duty of the citizens to overthrow that government and to establish a government that will give them those ethical rights.
Wow, John, I don't know how to follow that, but...
Yeah, it's the law and the ethics in the United States, and I didn't make it up.
Okay, I have a question that aligns with that point. I'm going to have to give you a little bit of a lead-in first, though. You ready? So in 1852, Frederick Douglass gave a scathing admonition to an audience regarding the 4th of July and the Declaration of Independence. And a mere 5 years later, in 1857, the Supreme Court doubled down on the fact that black people, whether enslaved or free, were not regarded as citizens of the United States, nor ever intended to be included in the words of the Declaration of Independence, which, as you said, begins with "we the people." Now, the court understood the document meant "we the white people," and it wasn't until white radical Republicans, ironically, in Congress in 1868 added a 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which transferred or transformed black people into black Americans, that we became part of the country. We became included as part of the country. Now, today, conservative Republicans supporting the Trump administration, they want to ignore the 14th Amendment. They want to destroy DEI efforts, and they want to stop funding the arts in black communities. So I'm going to ask you a similar question that Frederick Douglass asked his white audience in 1852. What to black Americans today does the upcoming celebration of the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence mean?
I think it means what the 14th Amendment says it means. The law is a functioning live body of thought, the Supreme Court is the tells us what the supreme law of the land is because they are the final answer, but they're not the final answer for all time. And so time can change and our views can change. And the two original sins of the United States, in my view, are slavery and guns, and they kind of go together. In terms of keeping down a segment of the population and denying, indeed, what the Declaration of Independence tells us is that all people are created equal.
Well, it's interesting because not only are we getting prepared to celebrate the Declaration of Independence, but at the same time, the 14th Amendment is under attack.
Well, I don't think any judicial officer worth his or her salt would buy that argument. It is absolutely clear what the 14th Amendment says, and it doesn't say what Donald Trump says it does. It says anybody who's born in the United States is a citizen.
Well, I love history because it gives us a contextual lens to understand what's happening today. And in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, President Andrew Johnson, who was impeached earlier that year for firing the Secretary of War, who was in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau, he issued a blanket pardon on Christmas Day in 1868 to all who had participated in the insurrection against the United States. And he also wrote this, quote, "This is a country for white men, and by God, as long as I am president, it will be a government for white men," end quote. Are we doomed to repeat this historical narrative?
Well, history is unpredictable to some degree, and the death of Abraham Lincoln was one of the great tragedies of the United States, not just because he was our greatest president, but because President Johnson then essentially undid the work of the Civil War, which was to preserve the Union and to liberate the slaves. Had Lincoln survived, we would be a very different nation today in multiple ways that I don't have time to, you know, sort of recount here. But the fact that President Johnson had a different view simply means that, you know, he really wasn't ever on board in terms of what the Civil War was all about.
I guess.
And just to put a coda on that, I mean, the Civil War killed 600,000 people. Yeah. Which was something like 12% of the population of the country at that time.
Yeah. It's a big argument that we're still involved in today.
Yeah.
My guest is John Frohnmayer, former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's also the author of many books, including a trilogy of adventure novels, the latest of which is titled Lyrics for Lara. Lyrics for Lara. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So let's switch gears and let's go right into that.
Okay. Well, I have had a lot of fun in my dotage here writing fiction. I wrote nonfiction for many years and thought that that was all I could do. But what I've found in writing fiction is that everything becomes relevant. You know, what I had for lunch or a conversation that I overheard or something that and then let me just give you one example of that if I can find it really quickly. I was driving up the Columbia Gorge, and part of the book Lyrics for Laura is about a travelogue trying to reintroduce Oregonians to some of the great wonders of the state. So it's the Columbia Gorge and the John Day fossil beds and Crater Lake that my characters visit in that first period of time.
She also visits Roseburg.
Yes, she does. I'm a little disinclined to go to Roseburg because I think they're going to throw books at me when I. but anyway, I as I was going up the Columbia Gorge, I stopped for a hamburger in a tavern, and I heard these two guys talking about hypodermic needles, and I thought, well, you know, they must be into drugs or something. And, you know, one of them kind of turned around and I said, "You have a drug problem here?" And he said, no. What we do is we inject our worms with hypodermic needles to make them float better so they don't sink to the bottom."
What?
and so I put that in a different context in the book because I just thought it was so interesting that would be and my point is, everything's relevant when you're writing fiction. These three novels, the first one has, which is called Blood and Faith, has to do with an international incident where an icon was loaned by Russia to the United States and stolen, and it becomes a conflict between the United States, Russia, and Ukraine. And I wrote that novel 30 years ago and put it in a drawer.
That's amazing.
You know, when the Ukraine war started, I thought, well, maybe I better look at this again. The second novel, which I wrote 2 years ago, is The Dangerous Illusion of Art, and it has to do with stolen art and faked art how that all goes about. And there's a very big business in both stolen and faked art. And in fact, art is one of the ways that crime launders money. The fake sales of artworks. And then this third book, Lyrics for Laura, has to do with a particular singer who becomes a paramour of Laura, without giving too much away in the book. And I have been a singer and guitar player all my life, and I look at the lyrics of songs and songs themselves as the shelves on which we store memories. And so it was particularly interesting to me to weave lyrics in throughout the story of this novel.
That's very poetic. The shelves upon which we store memories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. What's your favorite scene from this book?
A favorite scene from the book? Well,
I'll tell you this. I was immediately drawn in from the first scene where she arrives at the Portland airport.
Well, I'll read you just a little bit of that because it won't force me to think too much hard about what I like or don't like in this book. I pulled my bag off the luggage carousel and was jerked violently sideways as a mugger ripped my purse from my shoulder. Welcome to Portland. He took off down the exit, but I caught the blighter in three strides, tackled him, and we ended up in a pile in front of the Hertz counter where he smashed his nose into my elbow. I shoved him to the side so the squirting blood wouldn't get on my jacket, and the security folks hauled him away. Honestly, I don't have a target tattooed on my back. This stuff just happens. George didn't have to do anything. He just stood there with his hands on his hips, shaking his head. Nice tackle, said George's wife, Alma. George and Alma, he is an FBI agent who saved Laura's bacon in the first novel. Alma is his wife. They became surrogate parents of Laura in all three of these books.
That the way you start the book is just amazing because it instantly pulls you in. You're intrigued as to who these characters are because of the scene. How did you come up with that scene?
You know, I came up with it late in the course of the writing of the novel. I looked at it, and the first page of a novel is the most important page in the book because people pick it up and look at the first page, and you know if it's a downer, the book goes away. If it has some pizzazz, then you know maybe they'll pick it up. So I wrote it in one of the last edits actually. But I think that what's fun about doing fiction is just telling the story and trying to tell it in a way that is interesting and compelling to the reader, and so the reader has a stake in the story, and a stake with the characters, the good ones and the not so good ones, and that's what's really fun for me.
What inspired you to write these novels?
Well, I wrote Leaving Town Alive right after I left the Arts Endowment. That was in 1992, and it did pretty well. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I'm the next John Grisham, and I should write a novel here, you know. And I wrote the novel, which is Blood and Faith, and showed it to one of my college friends who was a professional writer, and he suggested I put it in a drawer. and that's what I did. And I'm sorry about that because, I missed 30 years of writing fiction.
I'm sorry about that, too, because we could have had much more of your writing. But now we have this trilogy, the latest of which is Lyrics for Laura. So I want to thank you, John, for joining me here in the studio. And is there any parting thoughts you have?
Well, all I would say, Mike, is that there's a fourth one on the way, a fourth book.
Excellent.